Welcome to this seminar on Beyond Burnout. My name is Dave Higgle. I'm the Director of Clergy Development, Clergy Care in Education and Clergy Development. And so happy and glad to have all of you come. Really excited about this seminar about Beyond Burnout. Our focus is not just on the burnout, but beyond the burnout. And I've asked these three gentlemen that I've gotten to know personally, who have some really good stories that I think many of you will resonate with. We're going to hear from each of them in just a moment. I just want to share a little bit about the format of our time so we know what to expect. I'll just do this little intro here, and then we're going to have each of them share their stories after we are introduced to them. Each of them will share kind of their story of how they kind of spiraled down and what their experience of burnout was like. Maybe some of the symptoms and causes, at least as they perceive those causes. And then we'll come back around and share what were the factors that helped. Share your story about what helped you come out of that burnout or to recognize it, and what were the factors that helped you to recognize that and get you back on your feet and back in ministry again. And I'm always aware of the story of Elijah. And obviously without going into detail about it, but the thing I love about the story about Elijah, if you interpret it sort of through this lens of burnout and stress and distortion of so many things in his life, it's not until he gets alone in that cave, right? Then he's able to hear the still small voice of God. And what I love about the story, though, is that God is basically saying, what are you doing here in this cave, Elijah? There is a way of looking at that story in a biblically, theologically accurate way, as prophets don't belong in caves. And so I'm not done with you yet. And I love that story because of the hope that it brings. And then we see Elijah re-engaging in ministry again. So this is the seminar of hope and encouragement to one another, and also one I hope that can spark honest conversations. So as I'm fond of saying, we have a whole division that has the word multiplication in it. And so this creates, in a sense, sets us up for performance, a performance-oriented type of ministry. And unchecked, if it's only that, we'll hear from these guys. They can share kind of how they dealt with some of that. But I want to just share just briefly a couple stats. As you know, we've been engaged with this study with Notre Dame University on clergy well-being. And I do want to say that tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., Chris Adams from Azusa Pacific University is going to be unpacking the results of that survey at a seminar called Flourishing in Ministry. And I noticed on the schedule it wasn't really well defined, that seminar. But that's what that is. It's getting the fresh results of the Notre Dame Flourishing in Ministry study that will unpack this. How many of you actually participated in that this year? Okay, this fall. A good number. We had about 700. About 22% of Wesleyan pastors participated in that study. So that gives us a really good indicator of clergy health and well-being. And I do want to share that the results on pastoral burnout in the Wesleyan Church are basically the same now as they were, roughly the same as they were 4 years ago when we did the first study. Roughly a third, maybe a hair over, a third of Wesleyan pastors are suffering moderate to severe burnout. And it's what we refer to as functional burnout. So you can still function, as these guys know very well, you can still function at a very fairly high level while experiencing burnout. So our time here today is to share their stories. I think the power is in their stories and how God worked through them as they learned to be vulnerable and to share what they were going through. And that just creates opportunity then for some honest conversation about how we can care better for ourselves as pastors and really as human beings, that's just what I wanted to share. On this side here, we got John Miller. John's been a pastor for many years, kind of transitioning now to retirement.
Still part-time.
But he's still, there's like no such thing in some ways, right? John is in Iowa in Cedar Rapids.
Falls.
Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls, Iowa. And is also a clergy care coordinator for that district. And then we have John West. John happens to be one of my pastors from Trinity in Indianapolis. And John is a church planter, a multiplier, apostolic kind of pastor, and is wired that way. He's got a story that some of you may have actually heard about, because I know he shared his story in different places. And then we have Zach Stamp, and Zach is in, what's the name of the town in Michigan?
Canton.
Canton, okay, I was going to say Canton, but I kept thinking Ohio. And is a pastor there, and similar kind of wiring in terms of getting things going and planting and helping churches to re-engage. So I'm just very thankful for each of these gentlemen, and also thankful for their willingness to be vulnerable and to share their story with each of us. So without any further ado, I'd like to just have a word of blessing on this, on our time together, and then we'll start with John Miller. Thank you, Father, for this opportunity to share together, to share our hearts, and to kind of launch some honest conversations. And I ask, Lord, that you would be with each of these three gentlemen as they share their story, that your spirit would work through that and show us where it resonates with our lives. And we will thank you for that, and help us to be an encouragement to one another as a result of what they have gone through. Lord, just may it multiply in such positive ways of encouragement in the lives of other pastors. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. After they're done sharing their stories, we'll open it up for questions or comments that you might have for any of the panelists. So we really want the folks to be on the stories and your questions, and so we'll have a little more interactive time afterwards. So, John, would you like to share a little?
Yeah, and just as a two-sentence prelude, I just want to say I am genuinely thankful today for the experience that I went through in this a number of years back. It's changed my view of God and of the church and of myself and of ministry. It's made me more compassionate. There's a lot of things that have happened, so I'm thankful for it. I hope never to go through it again. So with that, I was 49 years old, and honestly, I never saw it coming to me. I was disciplined in Bible study. I was faithful in prayer. I felt like I worshiped well. I worked at sharing Jesus with people, but I never saw coming the thing that hit me in the fall of 2001. Whether it's depression or burnout or what the title is, I'll let somebody else decide. But it was a devastating gloom that just kind of fell over me rather rapidly in the fall of 2001. And I didn't see it coming, but looking back, I can see a lot of mistakes that led up to that time, mistakes that I made, that I overlooked, that I didn't pay attention to. For instance, in the years of 1995 to 2001, I did not build into my schedule hardly any time for what it takes for me to refresh in ministry. As an introvert, I refresh by pulling back and taking time to remind myself who God is, who He's made me to be, what He's made me to do, what my limitations are, those kinds of things. It takes a little bit of time to do that. I didn't let any of that time happen in those years leading up to this depression. I was kind of the slave to what had to be done at the church, what needed to be done for this person, for that person. All of it was focused on somebody else. And I really didn't pay attention. 1 Timothy 4:16, Paul gives an instruction, a two-part instruction to Timothy. And I did the second part of that instruction really well. Pay careful attention to your teaching. And I put a lot of time into paying careful attention to my teaching. What I didn't do was the first part of that instruction. Pay careful attention to yourself and to your teaching. And I really ignored that first part. And I think I paid the price for it as I slowly was being drained of energy during that time. I made another mistake in thinking that teaching alone can drive a ministry. I am more teacher than leader. But in the role of pastor, you have to be both. I mean, there may be unique situations where that doesn't happen, but for the most part, you have to be both teacher and leader. And I made a mistake by not addressing my need to be growing as a leader. I needed to have somebody, I needed to have a coach, or I needed to have somebody to help me in that arena so that that side of life wasn't continually draining me. The teaching gave me life, leadership drained me, and I needed to address that much more aggressively than I did. Another big mistake that I made that I think led to that long depression, by the way, that depression lasted, it was dominating for a year, and it lingered for another year after that. So we're talking about a two-year time period here where it really wrestled. But I made a huge mistake in a couple of crises that our church faced, and if you're a pastor, you face crises in one kind or another. I handled both of them on the professional side, I would say, really well, and I think people would agree with me on that. But I never stopped to ask the question, what is the effect of these things on me personally? Again, we're back to how does this affect me as a person? I had to release a staff member for moral failure. And that is a crisis in a church, particularly when that staff member is a popular person. You get all kinds of opinions as to what you ought to be doing or what you shouldn't have done and all of those kinds of things. And we also made the decision, I think it was the right decision biblically, to work to restore this man to Jesus and to his wife and to the church. So we actually asked him to stay in the church and work through a process of restoration. And it, praise God, today it was, it's a beautiful picture. On my deathbed, I'll be happy that we did that, but it was an exhausting process. And it had a lot of personal cost to it in those days. And I didn't address the personal side of that crisis. And the second one, the crisis was even worse. The man that I hired to replace the man who was let go was the man who used to be my senior pastor. He had actually brought me into pastoral ministry. He was interested in being an assistant pastor at that point in his life. And so I brought him on staff as my assistant. And it was a unique situation, but it was one that I loved. And Dick was like an older brother to me. He was a mentor. He was an idea kind of guy. He could generate not only ideas, but action. And he was exactly what I needed to kind of supplement that, the weak side of my own leadership. And we had a wonderful time together, and the church did fantastic. We started a contemporary service back in those days. That was somewhat of a challenge. We restructured our Sunday school to make it more relational, help us make disciples rather than just present material knowledge kinds of things. We went through we built a building during that time. Attendance was going up every year. Giving skyrocketed. It looked like everything was in place for a future that was just tremendously bright. Until July 20th of 1998, when Dick and his wife were killed in a head-on crash with a semi. And that was just a devastating blow to me. Sorry, I didn't. It's 20 years later, but to lose Dick as a mentor and a friend and a brother and as an assistant. So there were all these factors that came at you immediately, and all this work that had to be done and all these decisions that had to be made, and now nobody was doing what Dick had been doing, and somebody had to be doing that, and then on top of that you had to find a new assistant in all of this. And the next 6 months were really a horrible time for me personally, but I did what had to be done for the church. I took care of the business that had to be taken care of for the church. But I never stopped to ask, I never stopped to grieve Dick's loss in that. So that, again, the personal side of that just wasn't anywhere to be found. I didn't take care of myself, as Paul instructed Timothy to do. And then our attendance started falling. And it fell again, and it fell again after several years of not fantastic growth, but good, steady growth. And, you know, there's something about, you know, as a pastor, when an attendance goes down, You feel that personally. It's like you are failing. It's like you are not getting the job done. You've been hired to do this, and you're failing. And you feel this personally. But instead of drawing people together and addressing this thing institutionally and in terms of how we go about changing this, I tried to just kind of slug it out myself, which, again, you see this pattern always. I'm not taking care of myself, and I'm not bringing other people into my life to help me deal with the problems that I'm really wrestling with. And then maybe the biggest mistake of all was that I didn't pay attention then to the warning signs that started showing up. I began to dread going to church on Sunday morning. I mean, every Sunday morning I felt like a hypocrite coming in to lead this church when inside I just felt like I wasn't doing well at all. I started keeping my office door shut all the time, you know, not just when I was studying. But I didn't want anybody to come in. I started putting off every decision that came to me. I started faking my happiness. And I'm a pretty good actor, as I think pastors can be. I'd have these imaginary conversations every Monday morning of what my resignation would sound like as soon as I could give it. And then I started, and this is the thing that really caught my attention, I started daydreaming about going back to my previous career. I'm a second career pastor. And I had walked away from my first career 20 years earlier, and I had never looked back. But in 2001, I started looking back and dreaming about going back to that. And I never stopped to ask, where are these thoughts coming from? Why am I doing this? And I never took the initiative to ask somebody else to help me sort it out. And that was my multiple mistakes I was making in there. So.
All right. Well, like Dave said, my name is John West. My wife's here today. We've got four girls and live in Indianapolis at a church called Trinity. I am a church planner at heart, apostolic, a lot of energy. The Enneagram is really popular now. I'm a three, which is a achiever and wanting to be successful and driven and do things, accomplish things. And so church planning was kind of my path, still is. Love to see God multiply disciples in churches. We planted our first church in 2006 in Dallas, Texas. We were there 3 or 4 years. And felt very clearly God was saying, called you to be a church planter, not a founding pastor. And so rather than being in Texas for another, you know, 20, 30 years, we felt like God called us to plant again. And at the time, I connected with a friend in Iowa, Minnesota, which is where we're from. We're from Iowa as well. I've known John for quite a while. And felt the call to plant a second church in Des Moines, Iowa. And so 2009, we moved to Des Moines, began the process. I told my wife, this is going to be the hardest year of our lives, I think, because it was in many ways a parachute plant where you just kind of come in. There were two small churches in Des Moines at the time, but we didn't have a large launch team. We didn't know anybody. And through a series of provisions and God just moving, the first year was awesome. We loved it. We had a great time. Got off the ground well. I'm going to go fast just because of time, but around 2013, so this would be about 8 years after starting the journey of church planting, I just began to just get tired. I mean, I was just tired. I really don't know if there's anything other than that. Just tired of the grind, tired of, you know, always building, always growing, coming up with ideas, moving forward. Just began to get weary, knew I needed a break, you know, reached out to a few people. Hey, you know, I need some time off, maybe a week, a couple weeks, I see, to get refreshed. I remember gathering my staff team together the end of 2013 and saying, you know, going into the holidays, I don't know what the deal is right now. I feel sluggish, I'm tired, I'm a little indifferent about ministry, and I don't know what's wrong with me, but I need to figure some things out over Christmas break, maybe take a little breather. You know, I was missing meetings, decisions, little decisions would need to be made, and I just, I'll do it later, that type of feeling. Went away for Christmas, began 2014, and discovered that one of my staff members had done something disappointing, hidden some things from me. I have a huge heart for racial reconciliation. This is a part of my story that's a hard part to admit sometimes. But huge heart for racial reconciliation. I wanted to see our ministry move in a multi-ethnic direction. And our worship pastor and the person that had kind of broken trust with me was African American. And so we were seen as kind of the, you know, African American worship pastor and the white lead pastor living life together as friends moving forward. And then this thing was discovered that he wasn't upfront with me about, and confronted him a number of times, brought one of our board members in to confront him as well, and he wouldn't come clean with some things. And so I realized I'm not going to probably be taking a break right now to rest for a week or two. It's going to take a little longer, and through a series of events, ultimately had to let that individual go. What I need to say about that, though, is a couple things. Number one, I was not in a good place to make a major decision like that. And looking back, I rushed the process. I didn't bring in all the people that probably need to be brought in. And I thought, I just want to put this behind me. You know, I'm tired of it. It's dragging us down. So I didn't have the mental energy because I was tired. I had about an eighth of a tank of gas, you know. In the tank. And then when we all the way up to the point of the resignation, in my spirit, I was tired, I was frustrated, and I didn't have full 100% peace. Now, I know in decision-making, maybe we don't ever have 100% peace, but I just went into that with an incredible amount of anxiety for a number of reasons. I saw a multi-ethnic dream starting to fade. I saw a friend of mine that I had to do something difficult in letting them go. I saw the future of the church at risk, and I began to experience anxiety. Anyone here ever had anxiety? Can I be honest? And I really mean this when I say this. I had never really experienced anxiety. I mean, not in a way that I did during that season. And it's awful. Like, anxiety is awful. I have so much compassion now for people that wrestle with depression and anxiety. And so when that decision was made, really the months of February to May, I felt a little bit like I've got to be the hero and the Messiah now. I can't be the you know, pastor that's going off on vacation for a week or two. And I began to really just wrestle with this struggle of, I don't have much gas left, I've got a lot of anxiety, but I can't leave, but I'm starting to feel like I can't stay either. I'm feeling a little trapped. And I went to California to visit my sister and just lay on the beach for a week, and I remember going to a counselor, and we had basically a 45-minute session, and I said to him, all right, we don't have much time, here's what I want us to do real quick if we can do this. Just tell me in the next 45 minutes, how do I make the anxiety go away? You know, I got my pencil out. I was being serious. You know, of course he did. Well, he didn't have a pipe, but, you know, I picture him with a pipe. He said, John, if you broke your foot or broke your leg and you went to the doctor and you said, hey, make this leg break go away. How do I make it go away? What he would tell you is put it in a cast. You can have to be immobile for 3 or 6 months. And over time, your body it'll heal. He said, anxiety is an emotional break. Something has happened in your life that has been broken, and this is going to take some time to heal. And for a mover, shaker, wanting to move forward, high achievement person, that wasn't something I wanted to hear. We found out in May that we were having our fourth child, which was a huge surprise for my wife and I. By the fall, I felt my joy leaving. My anxiety just continued to grow. I was weary, it was heavy, And I guess the best thing I can say is I really did feel trapped. I had moved back to Iowa to be closer to family. This was where we were going to raise our kids and stay for a long time. I didn't feel like I could go, but at the same time, I didn't feel like I could stay. And I lived in that for probably 3 to 6 months, through the summer and through the fall. You say, well, why couldn't you just step out? Why didn't you just step out, take a sabbatical, take a break? I don't know. So much of my identity was wrapped up in the church growing and building and moving forward, and felt like a sign of weakness. I didn't want to admit it to anybody. I just kind of hung on and kept moving forward. But you know, sometimes, what's the saying in Celebrate Recovery or AA? When the pain of staying the same is greater than the pain of change or something, people change. In November, I started to have dry heaves every Sunday morning in the shower before I had to preach. You know, people don't want to hear the pastor preach a depressing sermon week after week after week. And I'm high on authenticity and being real, but you know, just kind of pulling yourself up and preaching another joyful sermon when you don't have it in you. My body started reacting to that. And I remember really, really having a rough morning. I was on the couch actually crying, talking to my wife. We went into service, had one of our biggest Sundays, off Easter Sundays ever, end of November, and thinking to myself, you know, if I can only make it to Christmas, I'll be okay. If I just have a week in Christmas. Went away to Christmas break and came back Saturday night, January 3rd. I'll wrap up with this. I was sitting in my recliner Saturday night getting ready for my first Sunday back, thinking that that break, maybe, you know, 1 week off was going to do it. And I had a thought cross my mind. I just felt so depressed and so down. You know, we had a lot of people in our church that were from rough backgrounds. And I knew one of them that knew a drug dealer. And I had the thought cross my mind, I should make a quick phone call. I know who can get me some methamphetamines. And that'll just help me, you know, get through this next day, maybe the next week. I don't think I ever would have done that, honestly. But just the thought of that. I woke up the next morning, it was a Sunday morning, and I said to my wife, I'm not going to church today. She's like, you're the pastor. I said, I'm done. Like, I'm just done with it. And I called my associate and I said, you know, put in the emergency Andy Stanley DVD. And I'm not going. I'm done. And I really was. And I really felt like God told me, you're done. I don't want you going any farther in this. And so that will lead to the second half of my story in a bit. So,
thanks. Yeah. For me, and I mean this wholeheartedly, like a lot of my story is very similar to theirs, and chances are a lot of your stories are very similar as well. So I'm going to try not to repeat some of the things that they've shared just for the sake of time. But like Dave said, my name is Zach Stamp. I've been in ministry for about 14 years, various different types of ministries. I was a missionary in the Middle East for a number of years. I started a young adult, basically, ministry that exploded very, very quickly. When I was younger, was associate pastor at a growing, thriving church. Was courted by a lot of different churches in the Wesleyan Church to come be their lead pastor, and decided, you know what, I'm awesome, so I'm going to take a turnaround church. So God led me to a place where it was close to home, sort of similar to what John was saying, and I pastored a turnaround church, and we saw some pretty amazing things happen right away. Things happen at this turnaround church that you don't normally see at turnaround churches. And celebrating God, of course, and everything was great and everything was wonderful. Got invited to be a part of these different leadership circles and rub shoulders with people that are just quite amazing. But if I had to be really honest with you, and I've never said this publicly before, I really thought I was hot stuff. Like I really thought God was lucky to have me on his team. And, man, it sounds terrible to say that. But it's true. It's legit. About 3 years into this turnaround, we were seeing tremendous success. Things were going really, really well. We had various circumstances, much like these two guys talked about, that we had to face as well. By a personal crisis, my dad went through a pretty devastating stroke. The church seemed to plateau for the first time in my life. I wasn't seeing growth. I was seeing plateau or maybe even decline. And this is, maybe you guys can resonate with this, but for the first time I was receiving resistance to my leadership. Shocker, right? You're in ministry and you receive resistance to your leadership. And as a whole, I just felt like I was in a place where I was struggling and I didn't know what to do. So I'm like John, I'm a three on the Enneagram, which means I achieve and I'll do whatever it takes to take that hill. So I just kept pulling myself up by my bootstraps, white knuckling it through the difficulty, white knuckling it through the hardship, the missed expectations. And about 2 years ago, I reached a point where I just wanted to collapse. Similar to what John was saying, I just didn't want to go in on a Sunday morning. I love Jesus. I just was starting to hate the church. And I knew I had a problem. Actually, John told me his story a couple years before that, and I was like, uh-oh, this is starting to sound very much like John. And this is not going well. And I personally knew I had a huge problem when I wasn't able to handle, like, I didn't have the bandwidth to handle, like, everyday normal life circumstances. Things that would just be, like, things I enjoyed doing. For example, this was a big one for me. My wife was opening up a store. She's a manager at Starbucks. Thank you, Jesus. And she's like, hey, I can't get to the school to pick the kids up. This was my day off. And I can't get to school and pick the kids up from school on time. Can you pick them up? And I flipped out on her. I said things to my wife and about my children I never thought I'd ever say. And I knew something was wrong. And I felt like I was trying to tread water with an anvil tied around my ankles. And I just didn't know what to do. I felt inadequate. Felt like I was supposed to be awesome, but I wasn't. I was living this masquerade, if you may. And the only thing I could do was continue to pull myself up by my bootstraps and keep going. And that just, it didn't work. So.
Just before we transition to hear how they kind of came through that burnout, what were the factors that we want to talk about? What were some of the factors that they identified that helped them to recognize that they needed to have help? Who were the people or the resources that they were able to turn to that were really helpful? I thought just before we would do that, a lot of commonalities in their stories. You can hear various things, whether it's the anxiety, just changes in behavior that are just not their typical self that those who are close to them would certainly recognize, but how easy it is to go into the church on Sunday and put the smile on or to play the role. So that's what we mean about high function burnout is pastors can go a long period of time. The word is really that, you know, if you think you might be burnout, you're probably much further down that road than what you are at right now maybe willing to acknowledge. So there's some truth to that. The literature tells us, as far as this side of their stories, the leading factors that cause burnout, a big one, and we heard it from, I think, all three of them, workload. Workload is like one of the leading factors. And also, they didn't necessarily mention this one, but uncertainty. So one of the things that really creates a lot of pressure for pastors is the uncertainty from day to day about what any given day is going to bring. And that unpredictability, not only the heavy workload, but then all the unpredictable things that kind of, and that you have to roll with it. And we have to remember we're still human beings, right? So workload. Another thing is dysfunctional workplace dynamics is another one. And I was just thinking of John's story, John West in the middle here, with the staff member and having to let this person go. And there's probably stories leading up to that. But
workplace dynamics, if they're not healthy, can really lead. If they're not mechanisms in place to lead to good conversations and conflict resolution, these kinds of things. So workplace dynamics, poor fit. So I know, John, in your story, as I read, John Miller, as I read your story and as some of what you shared, some of what you were sharing was, and I think, Zach, also, in your story, kind of trying to be something in somebody that you're really not. So a lack of authenticity, researchers would refer to this as a lack of authenticity. You know, Shakespeare, to thine own self be true, right? A lot of truth in that. And yet trying to be something that you're not, or I think exactly the way you put it in your written story was reading all the books and trying to be who these people were in the books that were portraying themselves, but finally recognizing at some point, that's not me. You know, I can get help from those things, but that's... So poor fit, knowing your strengths. And Chris Adams in the seminar tomorrow, if he has time, we'll probably talk about the importance of playing to your strengths and knowing what your strengths really are, which is a real challenge in small churches for the pastor who has to do everything. So that's, we want to acknowledge that. Those are some honest conversations we need to have to help each other through that. I think the final one here, that these are major causes for burnout, work-life imbalance. So who are you when you're not pastoring? John Miller mentioned this, you know, not taking time to do things that I just enjoy doing. So researchers will refer to this as detaching, getting out of that role, doing things totally unrelated to work, right, that are refreshing, that put fuel in your tank. So those are some of the common causes. And I think, really, you reflect many of these things in your stories. So even though you have unique features, everyone's unique, but there are commonalities that run through, common features that run through all of these stories. So now I'd like to come back around and let's get beyond the burnout and talk about some of the positive things that took place that helped you to get out of that. So what were some of those factors, John?
Yeah, for me, especially for a guy who doesn't like to share what I'm my inner feelings and those kinds of things, you really get trapped in this thing of trying to hide everything. But I am thankful for a staff member who came to me in the fall of 2001. Obviously, he had noticed things that were wrong. Something wrong in me. And he asked me out for lunch one day, and he just asked me a simple question. He said, John, are you okay? Now, every fiber in my body wanted to say, yeah, I'm okay. Why do you think I'm not okay? You know, that kind of thing. But I thank God that I was willing to say to him that day, and I remember the booth we were sitting in even, no, I'm not. That's all I said. And I don't remember the rest of that conversation, but I'm thankful for that staff member who gathered together then eight men. We've got some tremendous men in our church. I'm at the same church still today as an assistant. My lead pastor is here with us today. I'm thankful that he gathered together a group of men who he brought then into my study one night so I could share with them what was happening in my life. And I tried to share with them what was happening in my life, and I just wept uncontrollably. I couldn't even talk. And here was this, you know, this cognitive, in control, personally in control kind of guy, the leader of all these men, weeping uncontrollably, trying to tell them what I was experiencing in life. And I think they saw a picture. They didn't hear from me what was wrong, but I think they saw a picture that something was wrong, something that they hadn't seen. And these guys worked then with our local board of administration. We call it Shepherding Board now today. But we call it that because of that depression experience. They worked with us, worked with me to give me a sabbatical. And it had a number of pieces to it that were really significant to me. And it had to include a medical checkup, of course, to make sure everything was right physically. It had to include counseling, which we worked out. And I met with a counselor for quite a period of time. It was very helpful to me to take a new look at myself through fresh eyes. It included a process with an organization that helps anyone who's in ministry kind of look at what the second half of their ministry is going to look like. I was 49 years old, so I was in the second half of my ministry years. Who am I by design? where does that fit into ministry, and how do you structure to do that in the remaining years of your life? That was a part of my wife and I both, who is also here with me today, both went through that process together, and that was really helpful to understand who I am and how God has designed me and what that has to look like in ministry. Then we could start asking the question, all right, if I do come back, and this was one of the gifts that the church gave to me, is when I went on this sabbatical, they gave me the freedom at the end to either come back into my role or to step out, depending on what I thought was better for me. That was a hard decision, because I don't know that I really wanted to go back, but I feared that if I didn't go back, it would be because I was running away from something. And I do not believe that God allows us to run away from anything, that He will bring it back to us in a different setting. So I felt like I had to go back to make sure I wasn't running away from something. And so all of this counseling and the process we went through helped me sort out, what does this ministry need to look like if I come back? What changes need to happen if I come back to this role? And so I made the decision that I would go back to work, but I had to be wiser about how I was doing it. I had to stop trying to do everything, which is a problem, and that is especially a problem if you pastor a small church, where you're almost forced to do everything. You really have to wrestle with how you address it, that one. But I determined I wasn't going to try to do everything. I decided that I needed to start spending more time praying instead of always doing. And at the root, that's a belief that God works, you know, and that He is God and that I'm not. And just I think the reminder to me of that was an important part. And then we did restructure our LBA. When I went back, I reminded them that when I came, I said, I'm more of a teacher than I am a leader, and I will need help in that. And they had all agreed to do that, but those things get forgotten over time. And I reminded them of that, and I said, we have to lead this differently, or I can't survive this. And so we changed our local board of administration, now called a shepherding board, to acknowledge that they have more leadership functions, not just administrative functions. So that I need them in a leadership capacity. So we're going to do this more collaboratively because I need help in that area. And that was a long process of changing that as well. But that's been a help over the years. And we're still, that's still always a work in process. But that was very helpful to me. And then the other big decision I made was that I had to be more aware of what is happening in me. And I had to pay attention to what I'm feeling and experiencing, and not only so that I notice those things today, because honestly I still experience a lot of gloom can still fall at an instant, the anxiety of what's coming can still rise, the uncertainty. Dave, I'm glad you mentioned that. Uncertainty is a big one. But I notice those things now. I notice when I'm walking really slowly, that's a symptom for me. And I'll ask myself, why are you walking so slowly? What's going on in here? And I'll process that a little bit. I really appreciate Pastor Peter, our lead pastor now, will often in our staff and I'm at the same church I was as a lead pastor, so that's kind of a unique situation too. But he'll let us get together and share what's happening personally. And I have to force that out, you know. But I know that I need to say to somebody what I'm thinking. And that's very helpful. So there's a couple other people that I can speak with. So I try to speak out now more what I'm feeling and thinking. And then I ask the question, where is this coming from? Why is this happening? Does the Bible agree with what I'm thinking about myself right now? That's always, for me now, a helpful thing, a way to process this stuff. And I'll just say this, it's still a battle. And I don't think it's ever not going to be a battle on this side of glory. Paul said, I have fought the good fight. So there's a fight in this thing that we have to address and be aware of. So.
Yeah, so, you know, following up part two that week as I was kind of figuring out what just happened and didn't go to work on Monday, didn't go to work on Tuesday, and I wasn't feeling good. I wasn't feeling very well. Everybody would hear. But meanwhile, I'm in my room contemplating, how do I get out of this? What do I need to do? Where do I need to go? And I called my district superintendent. You know, what's strange about this story in hindsight, and he and I have autopsied it many times. You know, I was kind of passive-aggressive about reaching out. So it would be, hey, I just need a break. One time I need a break. Well, hey, take a weekend then if you need a break. You know, I mean, or, hey, I feel like I need to get away for a few days. Well, you know, go for it. And I would hint a lot with him that I was struggling, but never fully followed through to say, man, I'm dying here. And on the flip side, he's, you know, talked to me, and he's in the room. He can chime in during Q&A and maybe share a little too. But, you know, he would see warning signs, but how deep are the warning signs? And, you know, well, that Friday I met with him, and he knew a little bit about what was happening, but not the extent. And essentially, I just broke down and started crying, and I couldn't get a hold of myself. And I said, I feel like I need to step down. And, you know, he said, whoa, wait a minute. What's happened here? And I said, well, I've got a physical, so my body's okay. I'm not in sin. I'm not sure what's wrong with me, but I can't keep doing this. And praise God, he said, I think you need to take, much like John said, you need to take a sabbatical. You need to take some time away. What scared me about a sabbatical is, so then what happens to the church? You know, in church planning and even as pastors, you know, there's a certain ownership we have for that flock, that group of people. We love them. And he said, and I'll step in every week if you need me to and keep that going. I'll just say not every DS would do that. Not every church can have that. For me, that was about the most incredible gift I could have been given, because it allowed me to take time away knowing that the church was going to be okay. And that's a dynamic that I had to learn during my sabbatical, that's God's church. That's not your church. I mean, you're an under-shepherd called to help serve, but ultimately that's God's. And so I was able to take a sabbatical in the middle of winter in Iowa in January with a pregnant wife, due any week to have a baby. Not good timing. I wasn't able to get away and do a lot of stuff. But a few things did happen during that process. Number one, for the first time ever, I went on medication. I know people think differently about it. I've heard some incredible Christian leaders, men and women I respect, that say, if you have to take some medication for a while, some antidepressant stuff, just do it for a season. Like, don't get dependent on it. But there are definitely physical things that happen. I did that for a little while. I began the discipline of journaling every single day. You know, you've all received in your books a book and a journal banding together, and I'll talk about that in a minute too. But the fruit of journaling in my life was so incredible, so huge, to spend time with God every day and reflect what I'm thinking. Like John, I wasn't always good at that. I had some trusted mentors and friends that I called that stayed in touch with me every week. I had regular check-ins with Tim and my district superintendent, some others. I did counseling for a season. I had a beautiful baby during that time, which gave me new perspective. But I think probably one of the biggest things that hit me, actually there's two things. Number one, I had placed way too much of my identity in what I do and not who I am as a child of God. And I made the implications of every decision that I made so big, put so much of that on me, that God was kind of like, he was helping me out as we did this thing, but I was kind of in the driver's seat. And I had this just realization during my sabbatical, man, you are holding on to this way too tightly, and you need to let go. I need to get fresh perspective. One of the things that really hit me during that season is I had spent a lot of time, and I'm kind of naturally, I like to gather people, I like to start things and all of that, but I had put all of my time into gathering, building, getting this movement going. But when it came to the call of God, the Great Commission, go and make disciples, I just felt like, man, I'm not doing a very good job with actually what God's called me to do, which isn't necessarily to plant churches, it's to make disciples. So not only was I not equipping the people, but I wasn't delegating the way I should. And part of that was because I had this, I don't know, maybe Messiah complex, like it's all on me to make it happen. And I want to share this one little thing. I'll go because of time, but I went to a pretty intense prayer counseling session a while back. One of the things that I felt like God asked me to do post-sabbatical is to do that. And they took me back to some moments in my breakdown, and one of them was the night before I had to announce that one of our staff members was going to be leaving. And he said, "Where was Jesus in that?" And I said, "He wasn't there." "Oh, he wasn't there during that tough decision?" "No, he wasn't there." They went through this process, and I began to see Christ at the foot of my bed, and it's a whole nother story. But at the end of the day, they said, "What's he saying to you now in that moment?" And I don't want to get overly spiritual here. I guess we're a bunch of pastors and leaders, so maybe it's okay. I really felt like that decision that I put so much weight in, I really felt like Jesus said to me, "It doesn't matter." You may have decisions you're wrestling with. I'm not saying they're not important. But when I heard Christ say, "It doesn't matter," what that meant to me was, you can go left or you can go right. You can decide for or you can decide against. At the end of the day, I'm still with you, and I'm going to lead you through it, and it's my church. And even if the wrong decisions are made, I'm still with you. It's going to be okay. We're going to move forward. Don't put so much pressure on yourself to make all these little things. And the second thing they said during that counseling time is, you know, Jesus says, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." And you are yoked to Christ, and as you are moving forward in ministry, he said, you're trying to pull all the weight like a tiny little cow, and Jesus is the bull, and you're yoked together with this giant ox, this bull, and you're trying to pull him along, and he's like, "Let me take the lead and move forward. Let me move this thing forward." So, you know, what helped me ultimately? Good people, support network of men and women that love me, fortunately that I had built ahead of time. Intense time with God every day when I was journaling my thoughts. A realization that making disciples is the most important thing. And I don't know how else to say it, but not taking the decisions I make so seriously and owning them and submitting them to Christ to say, "I'm going to move forward the best I can and let you take care of the rest." Those were a few of the things that really, really helped me on the backside of my sabbatical. Okay. So,
thank you. Now, I know we only have a few minutes left, and I don't want to shortchange Zach, but can you distill down, because I would like to open it for a couple of questions, because it's the importance of the topic. Can you distill down in just a few words, what were the critical things that helped you the most, just like what John sort of listed off, to help get you out of, you know,
through? I think for me practically, it was actually admitting, A, that I wasn't awesome, B, that I had problems and I needed to get help, and I had to stop living this masquerade. Let's face it, y'all, you're here this morning at 9 a.m. because you're processing through this very stuff. So, like, stop thinking you have to be awesome, stop putting the masquerade on, and start, like, discovering, God, who have you wired me to be? Stop trying, like, I was trying to be Kevin Myers. I was trying to be Matt Chandler. I thought, man, I have to be this poster boy, perfect pastor. And realizing that that's not who God wired me to be, but he wired me to be me, was absolutely essential. So I got hooked up with Dave pretty early through John, and I really spent a lot of time discovering, God, who have you wired me to be? And how does that intersect, like, with what you're doing. David Benner has a quote. If you've never read this book, it's called The Gift of Being Yourself. I would highly recommend it. He says, rediscovering your identity is found at the intersection of knowing God and knowing yourself. And I found that I was spending a lot of time trying to know who God was, but I wasn't spending any time learning who I was, or I thought I knew who I was. But what I was finding is that the gospel, what God wants to do is allow the gospel to invade those dark spaces of who I am. And it's there that I begin to rediscover who God's created me and where I begin to thrive and where the fit is good. So I spent, for me, a lot of time trying to identify through counseling, through reading, through journaling, through discussion, God, who have you wired me to be? Not who I want to be. Who do I think the world needs me to be? Who do I think the church needs to be? But like, who have you wired me to be? And learning to rest in that.
Thank you. Thank you all. Let's just give these guys a hand for sharing their stories. And one of the things I think that runs through their story, too, is this what they call self-reflection, the ability to say, hey, wait a minute, the awareness to recognize that something's not right, but then reflecting on that, where's that coming from, and then maybe to journal, write, start to talk to someone about that, having the courage to do that. We have time for a couple of questions. We've got 4 or 5 minutes. Yes.
My question would be, there's all spouses in the room as well. So, like, how did they process this? Obviously, they saw something.
Good question.
Were they like, I don't want to hurt his pride, you know what I mean? Or I don't know where to go. Were they confused? Who did they go to? How did they journey through it with you? Just, can you, anything you can speak to the spouses?
Yeah. Did somebody want to, how, just quickly?
I could just say, in my case, during that same time for me, Karen's father was dying. So she had kind of a crisis of her own going on there. And I think it wasn't until later that we realized that we'd kind of going through our own personal crises together, not really being a help to one another. So that was a reflecting back for us. Mm-hmm. It was a rough time.
But For me, again, my wife's here, but like she saw right through my junk. I mean, she could see it. I think a lot of people could see it. And I think spouses are a blessing for us when it comes to that stuff. In fact, if you haven't listened to Pete Scazzaro's story, he'll say the same thing. Like his wife was like, I'm done. I'm out, because she saw right through it as well. And I think a lot of us, at least as achievers, we have this dream of, I have to accomplish this. And everybody else sort of becomes like tragic in the wake of where I'm going. Listen, don't ignore what your spouse says to you. Mm-hmm. Like, ask them, do you see this in my life? Because mm-hmm. I think that they'll be very honest with you, because they love you. There she is.
I didn't know what to do. I knew he was breaking, but I didn't know where to go. So there were multiple times when I would communicate with his BS and say, hey, he's in a hard place. You want to stay in this world, but I don't. He's in a hard place. And that, I think, allowed other people to understand their name.
Good. Another question? Yes.
Disciplines that you put in place, whoever wants to feel this, that, you know, when you're feeling the weight of ministry, when you're feeling it on your shoulders, to just step back and remember that it's God's church, and Jesus. So what kind of disciplines do you use to remind you of that and keep you from stepping back into that place?
Okay, so the question is, what disciplines have you put into place in your life to remind yourself of who you really are, your real identity?
This is going to sound super spiritual, but pray. I actually put together, with the help of my friend, like a prayer statement that I pray through every day. It's like a page that combats a lot of the lies I believe about who I think I should be versus who I am in Christ. And I pray through that every day. And there are the warning signs on the bottom of that, and when I start, of what it looks like when I start to go down, I think it's what Peter Scazzaro calls like the shadow side of your personality, where it starts to go bad. Like, here, there's certain like warning signs. I put those on that paper, so I'm looking at them every day.
We're trying to encourage pastors, too, to create a rule of life. So Peter Scazzaro, who's here at this conference and speaking multiple times, can help. And there's a book called Crafting a Rule of Life by Steve Macchia at Gordon Conwell. Those are some good resources to help you get a framework for creating some good, some boundaries for yourself and some disciplines, but to carve those out between you and God. Yes, another question? Time for another question? Yes, go ahead.
Common denominator here, I don't know if it's a question, but maybe a caution. Mm-hmm. Common denominator here is the tyranny of success.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the church is partly to blame. Because what we do is we see a rising young superstar. We jump on that horse and we're going to ride it as hard as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, and I'm the BS that John's like.
Yeah.
And John and I came to the district at the same time. And that was the most successful church plant we'd had since the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I take part of the blame for not being sensitive enough.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And that brings up. Well, no, that brings up a good, and it's a good place to close. We're really talking about the culture of our church. What is the culture, the ethos of the Wesleyan Church? And so, the last few years, we've been working hard to try to create room and space for having honest conversations. And so, it's not negative thinking. It's just being honest about the realities of our performance-oriented culture, which the church has imbibed quite heavily, and so you, all of them have talked about their identity, who are they really? And I love John West's closing comment there about Jesus, you know, that, and John Miller mentioned this too, in a sense of, I'm not God, you know, and in a sense, Jesus says, who cares, you know, in certain things. So there's this tension between the performance and, of course, accountability. We all want to work hard. But then the flip side of that coin is grace. So we preach a gospel of grace and unconditional love and acceptance. And yet, for pastors, we get so caught up in that performance trap thing. It's so hard. So it's just constantly having, it's a tension. You know, that Wayne Schmidt talks about, we can't always resolve totally, but be aware. So I love this idea of awareness. Being aware and just pulling back at times, periodically, to say what's going on. And then this, the other key thing is the social support that they all talked about. Having people around you who will be honest with you and who will really care for you. And I want to say one reason we wanted to do this panel discussion with pastors, to pastors, is because the research is showing that in addition to spousal support, and the spouses is a whole other question, because they suffer too. And so we're working to address that. To work with spouses on that. I just lost my train of thought, my closing thought on that.
Can I just what say one just thing say? Before we wrap up? Just, you've got to talk to somebody.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, as I came on the backside of this, is I'm going to just, I don't want to share this story. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm done with it. I want to move on. But I really felt, and all three of us feel this way, you've got to start talking about it more. Reach out to somebody, mm-hmm. and don't reach out with the passive, hey, I'm kind of struggling, pray for me.
Or say, can I just have some time off?
Yeah, I mean, really have someone you can say, and if you can't say that directly to your district superintendent or whoever's in, tell somebody that can be an advocate for you to tell you this. I mean, find a way and take it seriously, because it's a downward spiral, and I got to the place where I wasn't sure if I was going to come back out of it. Mm-hmm. I was on the golf course telling my dad, hey, what if we went and built houses? Man, I don't even know how to hammer a nail straight. I knew God was not in that. But your brain starts thinking, I want someone to drive a UPS truck every Monday, deliver packages, talk to people, and just go home. Like, that would be amazing. You got to talk to somebody. That's the biggest
thing. Just on that point, the spousal support, but it's what John is saying, nobody understands like other pastors. And the research bears out that's even more than spouses. pastors understand more than even the spouses do because they're pastors. It's right up there with spouses, but the research will show it's scientifically valid that the number one is for pastors to be able to talk with other pastors. So this social support thing is really, really super critical. So thank you all for sharing your stories and for your questions, and let's continue to have these honest conversations and support with one another. Thanks.